You know, recently, Luke Perry died of a stroke. Bill Paxton, the actor, died of a stroke. Dick Clark, remember Dick Clark, had very serious speech issues following a stroke. What is a stroke? What are the implications of having a stroke? What are the signs that you're getting one? That's what we're talking about this week. Here are our guests. Let's start with you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Susie Bash. I'm a neuroradiologist, and I work for RadNet, which is, I believe, the largest outpatient imaging organization in the U.S., and I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Hal. My name is Parham Yashar. I'm a neurosurgeon and endovascular stroke specialist, and through Dignity Health and Northridge Hospitals, where our comprehensive stroke center is located.
One of the things that brings us together is Luke Perry, because oftentimes, we don't talk enough about strokes, but when a celebrity dies from one, that causes us to have a conversation in our communities. And so Luke Perry was 52 years old. A lot of people already saying that seems awfully young. What's your reaction to that?
52 years old is certainly young, but in terms of the risk of strokes across all ages, it's not that young, unfortunately.
What do you mean the risk of stroke across all ages?
So the risk of stroke can be stratified into patients above or below the age of 65. So depending on the statistics, it ranges from about two-thirds to three-quarters of patients who have a stroke are over the age of 65.
I've been 65 several times, and I a little humor sometimes is helpful, but it's a serious subject. And so when we talk about people over 65, are they more likely to get a stroke?
Just by age alone, they absolutely are.
Is that because our systems are more stressed?
Well, that brings up a lot of different points. Certainly, there's a number of risk factors that are involved elevating your risk of stroke. Age is a non-modifiable one, but there's many
others. Age-modifiable? What does that mean?
Is non-modifiable. You can't turn back the clock unless you're Benjamin Buttons.
I get it.
But otherwise, you know, age, your gender, for the most part, you can't change. But there's many modifiable risk factors you can do something about.
So do you want to talk about risk factors?
Sure. So the modifiable risk factors would be things like hypertension. That's actually probably the most important one. You have a fivefold increase of stroke if you're hypertensive, which is high blood pressure. So you really want to make sure that's in control. It's not something that you can feel. It's something that you need to get checked at your annual checkups each year. Another one is atrial fibrillation. That's an irregular heart beat that you can get, and it causes blood to sort of pool, and it can clot, and that clot can flick off to the brain and cause a stroke. That also is about a fivefold increase in stroke if you have AFib. There are other medical conditions such as diabetes or high cholesterol. Both of those can be controlled with diet and medication, and depending on how severe they are, because they are risk factors. And then there's lifestyle risk factors as well. So, for example, obesity, sedentary lifestyles. It's very important to exercise, excessive alcohol. Smoking's a big one, twofold increase if you're a smoker, diet, and also to avoid stimulant drugs such as cocaine and amphetamines.
What about recreational marijuana? Do we know the impact of that yet?
In terms of stroke risk, I don't think we know the impact of that.
Here in California, it's certainly legal if you're over 21 years of age, but I don't know that we understand what the impact of that is.
I would say, you know, certainly any kind of tobacco use and even vape use, nicotine use, can elevate your risk of stroke.
Well, that's because of the hot smoke going down into your lungs?
Either that or some of the chemicals and combustible agents within the smoke fumes themselves.
And they can damage the arterial walls. And then also the nicotine can increase your chance of high blood pressure as well. So it's a multifactorial component.
It's always interesting to me. And maybe I've just heard too many commercials, but at the end of a commercial that has to do with some kind of medication, they tell you all the things that can happen, most of which end up in death. And so it's kind of like, well, why do I want to take that medicine? Because it can cause a stroke. Or why do I want to take that treatment? Because it can cause a stroke. You know what I mean?
I know exactly.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these drugs, when they're investigating them on their clinical trials, all of the different side effects have to be listed. So if a patient is undergoing a clinical trial for an investigational drug, any kind of symptoms they have to mention to the study.
No, I understand they have to mention it, but it always sounds like, here's something really great, and by the way, you can die. It just has this sort of like incredible, it just it's like a pause, you know? It's like...
That's true, Hal, but, you know, there's no such thing as a clean drug. I mean, all drugs can have side effects, and they affect people differently. So you always have to weigh the risk, you know, versus the benefit of the drugs. But certain drugs are really life-saving, and so if it's really important. If your cholesterol is very high, up to 250, 260, you really need to be on that medication and stick to it and sort of, you know, maybe not focus so much on all the negative things about the drug. I mean, for example, for stroke, one-third of patients stop taking the drugs that are recommended by the doctors.
Oh, otherwise they would have been okay.
And they stop taking it within 3 months. And the problem is 3 months, within the first 3 months, is your highest risk for having another stroke.
Wow. Well, and the difference between a stroke and a mini stroke? Because there is a difference.
So mini stroke is a term we use for what's called a transient ischemic attack, or TIA.
Right.
Essentially, it's a temporary set of symptoms that you experience that lasts less than 24 hours and resolves over time. When you get an MRI, and again, Dr. Bash can probably tell you more in specifics about that, but an MRI shouldn't show any definitive signs of an actual stroke. A stroke itself is unfortunately permanent. You've lost function of those brain cells, and you can't bring those back.
Yeah, I want to hear about that. How many brain cells do you lose during a stroke?
Okay, so for every – let's first define a stroke. So a stroke is brain cell death due to a lack of blood flow, low blood flow, okay? There's two different kinds of strokes, an ischemic stroke where you have a lack of blood flow due to a blood clot, and then there's hemorrhagic stroke, which is a brain bleed. And that's due to leakage or rupture of a blood vessel. And you can think about it sort of like a garden hose pipe. So whether you have a blockage of the pipe or whether you have leakage or rupture of the pipe, either way, the flowers aren't getting watered. And our brain cells are very, very sensitive to oxygen. They need that blood flow for the oxygen. So a large vessel occlusion stroke, where we take out a large vessel is blocked, that will cause brain death. And that brain death is permanent. And the drugs that we use to treat stroke are not trying to fix the cells that are already dead. We lose 1.9 million cells,
correct,
every 1 minute without blood flow. So time is brain. Quite literally, time is brain, which is why it's so important that 911 is called right away, which is also means why we need to be able to recognize the signs of stroke.
So you have strokes, and then you have blood clots, and then you have aneurysms.
Correct.
Are they cousins of each other, or are they all the same thing?
They're I would say cousins, absolutely. When an aneurysm, so we'll define what an aneurysm is. An aneurysm is essentially a weakness in the side of an artery, and as that weakness progresses, it balloons out. So just like a balloon can pop at some point, or an aneurysm can rupture, and that rupture leads to bleeding in and around the brain.
You know, I was talking about how, you know, you listen to these commercials and they can be kind of freaky, listening to all the things that are bad that can happen. But it really is remarkable how fragile we are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I hear things like this, I'm thinking, wow, I mean, you know, a little itty-bitty thing can kill us.
It's a fine balance. But the good news is that 80% of strokes are actually preventable. I mean, I don't think people realize that. But all of these modifiable risk factors we talked about, I mean, that's a lot of things we can all do as human beings to sort of reduce our risk for stroke.
So let's start to talk about some of those. Exercise?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Diet?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So diet and exercise are probably the easiest ones that you can try to modify with the help of either your nutritionist and even your primary care physician. You know, as Dr. Bash mentioned, hypertension is one of the leading causes of stroke risk. And one thing that's very important to point out for all of these risk factors is they don't give you any symptoms. You have no idea your cholesterol level is elevated. You have no idea you have high blood pressure. If you have diabetes, you pretty much don't really know that your glucose is elevated. So most of these symptoms and these risk factors are very silent.
That's amazing. I mean, so when we talk about these sort of risk factors and things like that, there are symptoms to look for, and we have something sort of called BFAST, which is sort of a way to be able to look for certain aspects of impact, right?
So BFAST is a mnemonic that we use to look for signs of stroke. So as we were talking about, it is so important, it's so critical to call 911 when someone starts having a stroke. But we can't do that unless we know what signs to look for. So BFAST is a mnemonic. Well, first of all, it's important to realize stroke symptoms are sudden onset. And if the stroke occurs on one side of the brain, let's say the right side of the brain, it will typically affect motor function on the opposite side of the body, on the left side. So if you see someone that has sudden onset neurologic symptoms, you should be, the first thing you're thinking in your mind is a possible stroke. So BFAS, the B stands for sudden onset balance difficulties. The E stands
eyes.
For
any deviation in the eyes.
That's correct. The F is for face, asymmetry in the face.
So like if you're drooping on one side.
Drooping on one side, your smile is sideways. A is for arm, if one arm's drooping or appearing weak. And S is for speech, slurred speech or confusion. And then T is the time. It's a reminder that we must call 911 immediately.
And
so I was just going to add, the important thing to note is this is something you or your family member can literally do right in front of you in your home. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be a physician to check the face, or, you know, ask your family member to smile. Ask your family member or even check yourself, can you raise both arms equally into the air? So these are very simple things you can do literally within seconds to decide whether you think your family member, your loved one is having a stroke.
There are all kinds of new devices, all kinds of new medications. Can you sort of address some of that for me?
Sure. So after 911 is initiated, the paramedics will bring you to a stroke center. There's two types of stroke centers, a primary stroke center and a comprehensive stroke center. Comprehensive, the difference is that the comprehensives will have a neurosurgeon and a neurointerventionalist on staff. And, you know, in some cases, like in your case, you're actually both, but usually it's two different people. And so you're brought there, and with the new advances in stroke treatment we've now come to understand how important time is. We now bypass the ER, so the patient never has to go check in at the ER and be triaged there. They go straight back to imaging. They can either be imaged with MRI or CT, and we do advanced level imaging with both. MRI has the advantage that it's more sensitive and specific, but CT has the advantage that it's more readily available and it's quicker. And since time is of the essence, patients are usually always brought to CT. So first we do a non-contrast CT of the brain, and we make sure that there's no bleed. Okay, blood looks bright on CT. And we'll also get an idea sometimes of where that stroke is forming. Then after that, we inject contrast into the patient's vein, and we do a CT angiogram, where we're looking at the vessels in the brain. And there we can actually see where that clot is, and that's critical. We need to know. We can't do any further intervention until we know where the clot is. If it's a large vessel occlusion, we want to initiate TPA if we can. TPA stands for tissue plasminogen activator, and that's the FDA-approved clot-busting drug. And it's a drug that has risks. Not everyone can take it. And also, you have to be within a 4.5-hour window to give TPA. It used to be 3 hours. Now it's 4.5 hours. But if you can...
There's a lot you've got to think about.
And so, and then just in getting back to imaging, there's one other imaging study that we often, or not often, but that can be done, and that's CT perfusion. And that will help us differentiate between the infarcted core, that's the brain tissue that's dead, that we can't do anything about, and the penumbra, that's all the brain tissue surrounding the infarct that is at risk for dying but is still alive. That's what we're trying to save with our interventions. So if you're a candidate, the TPA will then be started at that point. And then the patient often goes for mechanical thrombectomy, where they can actually deploy a stent-like device into the clot and pull it out.
And so extracting the clot,
that's correct,
is a desirable way to go.
Exactly. So that's one of the procedures we perform, and there's been several recent publications demonstrating that this should be the standard of care.
How often do you perform this sort of procedure?
I'd say on a weekly basis.
Really?
You know, at Northridge, we run our stroke center over the last year and a half, and even this past week, two of these procedures I performed.
Well, what's your stroke center like, by the way? I'm just curious.
So Northridge Hospital has been a primary stroke center where we've offered TPA as initial treatment for patients for several years, even before I started there about 7 years ago. In December of 2017, we opened our stroke center to include interventional procedures. So as Dr. Bash mentioned, this means taking patients and offering emergency procedures to try to extract a clot when we see a blockage on an artery. In the last year, in 2018, we performed about 60 procedures. Many of those are from the local area. Some of those patients were transferred from other local hospitals as well. And it's been growing ever since.
There was a number we talked about earlier. It was like every 40 seconds there's a stroke.
Every 40 seconds in the United States, a patient experiences a stroke.
And every 4 minutes?
And about every 4 minutes, a patient passes away from a stroke.
Stroke is actually very common. I mean, it's the fifth leading cause of death in the United States, and it's the second leading cause of death throughout the world. It's also the number one cause of adult disability. I mean, number one, because most patients that have a stroke end up having some long-term disability from the stroke. And there's a huge financial aspect to that, and also caregivers and everything else that's involved. So again, the earlier we can get them there and earlier we can get them treated, the more amount of brain tissue is salvaged, and the better the patient's going to do.
And you talk about the long-term impact of this. It could be you're paralyzed on one side. It could be you can't talk. It could be any number of things.
Absolutely. It could be that you're not able to even communicate. So not even just speaking, but you can't communicate. You can't
understand. Why is it that it sounds to me like it's a death sentence when you get a stroke? I mean, it feels to me like the ramifications are so severe in some of these situations. You can be a prisoner within your own body. You can't talk anymore. You can't motion. You can't do this. It sounds horrible.
Well, Hal, the thing is if you can survive the initial period, so everyone that has a large stroke is going to have brain swelling. And that brain swelling maximizes at day 3 to 5. That's your most dangerous period. And actually, young people, it's a very important point as we're talking about younger people, because younger people have a bigger problem with this because their brains, as we get older, our brains all start to atrophy or shrink down in size. And so the younger population that gets strokes, their brains are still very full in volume. And as they swell, that volume presses against the inner, you know, part of your cranium, and there's not any extra room to go. And so it can actually accelerate brain tissue injury. Whereas older people would have more room to swell. But if you can survive the initial insult and after the swelling goes away, I mean, I do 100% neuroradiology in my practice, probably 50% spine, 50% brain. There's not a single day where I don't see numerous infarcts. I mean, it's just a huge...
And define infarct, just so, because you can have a heart attack and there's an infarct from that. Let's just describe
Good
what
point.
That is.
That's correct. Yeah. So in my area, I'm talking about, you know, cerebral infarct, so a stroke. I see strokes all the time. A lot of strokes are just what we call lacunar strokes in the white matter of the brain, and that's really the patients sometimes don't even realize they have that. The cortical strokes that are larger, those are the ones that start to cause deficit. Where they are in the brain is the most important factor of what kind of deficit you're going to have. So, for example, if you have a stroke involving the cortex of your primary motor cortex, you are going to have weakness on the opposite side of the body. And so the size of the stroke matters and where the stroke matters. But there are, you know, there's, I mean, we see that every day, all the time on imaging. So you certainly can survive a stroke.
You know, my dad, who was diabetic and had mini strokes, and that's why I know something about mini strokes. It felt like to me that he just kept getting attacked by these little mini strokes. Can you explain what that is?
So certainly, from the standpoint of his diabetes, you know, one question is how optimally was that controlled? You know, we can check hemoglobin A1C levels, which is an estimation for the last 3 months of how well or how tight somebody's glucose has been monitored and adjusted. Certainly, patients who have diabetes are also at risk for other risk factors, including hypertension and hypercholesterolemia. Equally important when someone has a mini stroke or a TIA is to have a full workup done to try to understand what are some of the additional risk factors for them. Certainly, some of those studies that can be included would be a Doppler, which is basically an ultrasound looking at blood flow through the carotid arteries in the neck.
Making sure it's actually flowing like a river.
And making sure it's flowing, making sure it's not narrowed. So we look for stenosis, which is the medical term for narrowing. We look for a certain degree or percentage of stenosis. And certain patients who have a high degree or they have a moderate degree but are symptomatic, meaning their MRI showed some area of stroke in the location of where that blood is flowing from, can benefit from either what's called a carotid endarterectomy or even carotid stenting in certain cases.
It's amazing. It feels like you almost need a dictionary to understand some of this, you know. But the bottom line is that strokes are a real part of everyday life, and you can get hit with one and never know what hit you.
Absolutely. Well, one thing I wanted to add to your point earlier was it really depends on the location of the stroke. So there's certain parts of the brain that may be what we call relatively silent. A stroke in that area may not even give a patient any symptoms. And that could be, for example, the right frontal lobe, which is a fairly silent portion of the brain. And then there's other strokes that may be small, but they're in such a critical portion of the brain that they affect the speech so badly that a patient is unable to communicate, to either understand or to be able to speak themselves.
You know, I mean, again, this gets back to how bizarre I can be sometimes, but the whole notion of would you rather die from a heart attack or a stroke? I mean, they're all so awful. You know what I mean? It's like none of this stuff is really desirable, obviously. And so the most important thing is just do what you can, because even if you do what you can, it doesn't mean you're going to skirt the issue.
You're absolutely right.
You may still get nailed. And is a lot of that in your DNA?
Some of it is. Absolutely some of it is. There are certain genetic mutations that elevate your cholesterol levels. Certainly patients who have a family history of heart attacks are at further risk for heart attacks themselves.
Yeah, I'm thinking about getting a boat and leaving. What the hell, you know? I'm like, whoo! So what do we want to leave everybody with?
I think the most important things are to understand what are your risk factors and what can you do about them. And what you can do, do something about them.
And remember, be fast.
Absolutely.
Remember
That's
that
correct.
The B stands for?
Balance.
E stands for eyes.
That's correct.
Correct.
F stands for?
Face.
A stands for arms.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
C stands
S.
I'm sorry. Be fast. Right.
Yeah, so
look, I can't even spell now.
S stands for speech.
And
I would throw confusion in there as well.
I'm confused. I'm confused. But the most important thing is if something doesn't seem to be right, then do something.
Absolutely.
Correct. Ask for help.
Definitely.
Don't just stand there and say, gee, I kind of feel bad at the moment. Yeah, ask for help.
The key thing is pick up the phone and call 911. That is the best possible thing you could do. So the ways that we can help is to modify our risk factors. And by the way, if you don't have to memorize these, you can just go to put in your web browser, stroke.org. It will take you to the National Stroke Association website. You can print out under resources the stroke risk scorecard and just check off. And then bring that to you when you go to your annual physical and talk with your doctor about modifying those risk factors. So modification of risk factors and being aware of what stroke signs are. Those are the two most important things that we can do to help.
And don't forget the word be fast, because I think that's a great way to remember what the symptoms are of a stroke if you, God forbid, are having one. Thanks for joining us. If you haven't already, please subscribe. Give us a few stars, like a pat on the back if you don't mind. And we'll see you next time for another edition of What the Hell?